Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. We are in season 10. Look at us. We are growing, y'all. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to us. We have a very special guest for this episode. In fact, he is the founding producer of University Drive. We have Dr. Ian Strawn joining us for this episode. Welcome, Dr. Strawn.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure to be back. Always good to be in your company, and it's a nice to come back home to University Drive.
We are doubly excited, not only because you've come back home, but because we get to talk about something that's really interesting and important. And that is, you've come out with a new piece of literary work that I find very intriguing. In fact, it has us thinking very deeply about the kind of legacy that we have as Bahamians. I'd venture to say that a part of our legacy is one of oppression, but another part of it is also about our indomitable spirit, our spirit of resilience, getting knocked down seven times and getting up eight times. And you have decided to focus your imagination on the story of poor Black Kate, the slave girl, on a plantation in Crooked Island very many years ago. And her story became one that was used to sound a cry for why we needed to abolish slavery. And you've taken an imaginative approach to telling that story as a novel. And to me, that is very fascinating. Tell us about what propelled you to dig into this.
Right. So thank you. I guess there are two ways to explain the why. The first is that I've always been a lover of history. It was my favorite subject in high school. I had a wonderful teacher by the name of Cecilia Swan, who left us way too soon. And she was different. In our 10th grade at Government High School, we did African history. She had been a UWI student, had gone to university with my mother, actually. And we studied the kingdoms of Songhai, Mali, Zimbabwe. And then we went into the O-level curriculum in grade 11. And so I had a rich introduction to the study of where we came from and of the past. And as a scholar, I always, gravitated towards wanting to understand our history, how we became the society we became, the acts, the choices, the decisions, the movements that shaped us. And came across the story of Kate in a book by the late Gail Sanders, Slavery in the Bahamas, and made a mental note. And it was of personal interest to me because I am actually a descendant of the Moss slaves. My mother's family, the Moss side, is from Crooked Island. She's also a descendant from Hannah's of Acklands. And so this happened on the Moss plantation, which is around Landrill Point in Crooked Island. It happened in 1826. And I made a mental note that I wanted to explore this. I wanted to write about this. And then in 2008, I had the opportunity, 2007, 2008, to get a sabbatical to begin to work on it in earnest. And it's 15 years later now. We've finally been able to release the book. But it was important because it's my view that Bahamians have a skewed or rose-colored view of our past of slavery, if I can be so bold as to say rose-colored, in the sense that the general line, the orthodoxy is slavery wasn't that bad in the Bahamas, right? We, as compared to the larger islands where there was intense cultivation of sugarcane, like your Cuba, your Jamaica, your Haiti, your Puerto Rico, your Trinidad. And because we didn't have that economic drive, that intensity of labor, it is assumed that we didn't have brutality, that we didn't have dehumanization, and that there wasn't much suffering. And archaeologically, people have been able to demonstrate, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the lifespan of slaves was longer in the Bahamas. So I don't wish to dispute the fact that there are significant differences and that the mortality was greater. We know that there were more, or at least very visible insurrections on those islands, even in Barbados. But we had our own. We had our own resistance, as you put it. But more importantly, slavery is slavery is slavery. In other words, you capture people from one place, you take away their God, you take away their names, you take away their clothing, you take away their family structure, you take away their language, you hold them captive, you take them across the Atlantic Ocean. They will never return to the place where they have been since the dawn of humanity. And you make them work for you for the rest of their lives. You hold them captive, and you hold their children captive, and you hold their children's children captive. And the usual things, confinement, whipping, were rape. These were all part of slavery in the Bahamas. We were property. And so I wanted to, this story was for me an opportunity to almost provide an intervention, to fill in a gap for our people, where there's just this, to me, a cloudy place, an empty place. We don't understand. And you notice we don't actually recognize or preserve our slave plantations. We don't. They've all been overgrown with bush, most of them. And I actually went to Crooked Island to find this plantation site, deep into the woods. But for the most part, we don't see the monuments and recognize them as the markers and the symbols of our captivity and our oppression. Okay. So there's this disconnect. And as an artist and as an intellectual, that is what I've been preoccupied with, is why I wrote my book Paradise and Plantation, in the sense that here we are, we call ourselves paradise, we produce paradise for foreigners, but this society is one that was built on slavery, and is also a society where the economic model is a plantation model. It's one that's extractive and exploits, and we don't own it. No, there are no whips at the hotel. I get that. There are no chains. But the continuity in terms of the economic model is still there. And so the reason I did this, the reason I was prompted, moved to do this, was for the things I just mentioned, a desire to tell our history. And then, of course, I had to tell it imaginatively, because there aren't any oral accounts. In some societies, you have that. Some slaves, they did interviews, they wrote their own, with assistance, got their own story written. Kate's story is only found in the documents which have been preserved in the museum, in the, sorry, not the museum, in the Bahamas Archive and in the British Library. And thankfully, there's a lot there, actually. Because she was killed, tortured and killed, and then there was a trial, and the minutes of that trial still exists. The letters from, and I know I'm just talking a lot, I'm not letting you get in there, but the letters between the governor and the colonial secretary are still in existence. And so Those things allowed me to piece the story together. The other thing I would say, and just in terms of why do this, because as I think about it, as a writer, you have to ask yourself, what story do you have to tell? Why is it important to you? And why would it be important to others? And can you tell that story better than anyone else? And lastly, will it ever be told if you don't tell it? And so I felt a certain sense of purpose around this, to honor Kate and to tell her story. And it was hard to do it, and I put it down many times, which is why it took so long, because it was kicking my butt. But I'm very grateful that I was able to do this, and I hope and pray that I've done her story justice.
I am trying to reflect and process everything that you've said. You've said so much that gives context and helps us to think about this. You know, you say slavery, I say trauma. And sometimes trauma lingers and it festers. And a lot of times we're not aware that we are either being impacted of it, the product of it, and the extent to which it really helps to shape who we are, not in the defeatism of trauma, but maybe in the resilience and overcoming it and learning from it and giving voice to it, talking about it. And a part of talking about it is actually knowing about it and documenting it. And so there I see your work in the mix of all of that.
No, I like that. I mean, I think it's important that you use that language, the language of trauma, which we relate now in our own moment to, around the harmful things that happen to us during our lives, usually through no fault of our own, right? Abuse, loss. We are part of a gigantic event like a Hurricane Dorian, or in some cases now you see people, huge forest fires or earthquakes, like the one that happened in Haiti. So we know that the trauma is this tremendous pain and psychic anguish that happens with something terrible happens to us that we can't control. Now think about that in your own life, because you can't go through a journey of life and not experience trauma. Now multiply that by 15 million souls. All right? And you have a sense of the magnitude of what was done to Black people. Right? I often try to draw people to the way the Jews, 6 million Jews, perished and how they suffered, but also how they remember, how they refuse to forget, how they refuse to let anyone else forget. All right? But we seem to be wanting to forget our past, uncomfortable with it. We don't want to sit with it, and we certainly, in our tourist economy, where we are serving a majority white clientele, I suspect that there's a level of reticence, doubt, uncertainty about race relations, period, but the history of slavery, which is our history, right? So, these are monuments that we don't want to honor. And again, when you don't acknowledge something, you don't deal with something, it lingers, right? So if you don't deal with this history, then you have people who don't love themselves, who really believe white people are smarter than them, more beautiful than them, more ethical, more moral than them, more trustworthy than them, right? You grow up and you might believe that Black people really are lazy. There are so many ways that slavery is a legacy that is present in the moment, in the very moment. The things we say to each other, come from around with your Black self. That's a very interesting, okay. You could just say, go away, come from around with your Black self. So the very fact that you're Black is a part of the problem with you. It's why you disgust me. So
Yeah, we
the
could take that even
self-hate,
further, blacklisting.
yeah. So the self-hate The inferiority complexes, the self-sabotage. This is all a legacy of slavery. But you're also right. I didn't want to write a story that was just going to be a downer. I didn't want to write a story that would just be about defeat. I didn't want to write a story that just make everybody sad, right? I wanted to write a story that yet could inspire people. And I believe, I certainly hope, that is what Blind Days does. Because in essence, what you have is you have a slave girl who stands up to the powerful, who stands up to her owner and her master and her mistress, and refuses to back down. Refuses to back down. And she pays for that. But look at what happens as a consequence. They confine her, they put her in stocks, they put her in a barn, they basically imprison her because she refuses to obey them. But in the end, they are the ones in prison. So this girl pulls down the whole plantation system through her one amazing act of refusing to obey. She didn't use a gun, she didn't use a torch, she didn't use poison, she didn't set anything on fire. She just said, "This is my body, and I will do with it what I wish, and I will not do what you wish with this body."
And
Right?
she takes on the whole establishment,
She does.
a young girl.
And not only does she, and then that story, as you pointed out at the top of the show, becomes a clarion call across the Atlantic in the halls of English Parliament to help move the abolitionist movement forward. And you mentioned it when you use the phrase poor Black Kate. That's the name of the pamphlet that was published by the African Society, promulgating, telling her story, and exposing the cruelty of slave masters in the Bahamas, the place where slavery was supposedly, peachy, cool, easy.
All of this is mind shifting, and I want to read something that you wrote. You said, readers meet those who were devoted to the master and mistress, and those who refused to be treated like animals, those of the slaveholding class who were capable of compassion and restraint, and those who were unapologetic and without mercy.
Yes.
Why the title Blind Days?
So, Blind Days comes from a poem by Martin Carter. Martin Carter is a Guyanese poet, and he has a poem called "I Come from the Nigger Yard." And it's a beautiful poem about our origins, about our history. And in there is that line, that phrase, "Blind Days." All right. And it just stuck with me. In the nigger yard, I was naked like the newborn, naked like a stone or a star. It was a cradle of blind days rocking in time, torn like the skin from the back of a slave. It was an aching floor on which I crept on my hands and my knees, searching the dust for the trace of a root or the mark of a leaf or the shape of a flower. And one of the things that happens to Kate, she's confined in the stocks for 17 days. She's repeatedly whipped. But another thing that they do to punish her is that they rub pepper in her eyes. Repeatedly, they rub red pepper in her eyes. And when I remembered this poem, it just stuck to me as a wonderful launching point for this novel. And so Blind Days speaks to what this girl went through, but also really all of slavery were days of blindness, right? Where one group of human beings decided that another group was absolutely, were just animals, were people that they could just treat as chattel. And that stands to me, I really do believe this, as they're to me the two greatest crimes of the last 1,000 years. was African transatlantic slave trade and slavery and the genocide of Native Americans. And this is a crime that we've yet to receive justice for, right? So yes, that's why the title Blind Days.
Awesome. We are going to take our first break right here. Pause on your thoughts. We're going to come back after this.
Are you ready to take your knowledge or career to new heights? Don't wait to invest in your future. Do it now. How? Earn a professional development certificate from University of the Bahamas. Whether you're looking to enhance your leadership abilities, sharpen your technical skills, or explore a new field entirely, our Continuing Education and Lifelong Learning Center has the ideal course for you. We offer single-phase electrical, ethics in procurement, accounting for entrepreneurship, stop managing, start leading, dynamic presentations, digital marketing, superior customer service, and justice of the peace. We even have courses on smartphone photography, TikTok videos, defensive driving, and interacting with difficult people. Or open the door to new languages with English as a second language, conversational Chinese, and Spanish in the workplace. Our instructors are experts in their fields, and they're here to support you every step of the way. Call us at 302-4449. Enroll today.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies, and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to University Drive. We have as our guest, Dr. Ian Strawn. He's talking about Blind Days, and it is a novel that he wrote about the story of Kate Moss, the slave girl at the plantation in Crooked Island in 1826, who was tortured and eventually died. We are talking about chattel slavery. We're talking about the dehumanizing things that slaves endured. We're talking about this story and how it became something that caused a major shift. Dr. Strawn, can you share the process of how you blended historical accuracy with your imaginative storytelling? I mean, this is a novel, but it's based on things that actually happened. How did you navigate that?
Yeah, I mean that's the key right there. So again, you know, I began with the facts. So it's a true story, right? So you know that this girl existed. You know that she was a slave. You know that she was tortured. You know that she died. And as I mentioned before, the minutes of this trial still exist. I was also able to retrieve the slave registry of 1822. A lot of people might not know, but in 1822, the most popular name was not Roll, it was Moss. James Moss owned more slaves than Lord Roll did. But at his death in 1822, many of his slaves were sold, and they were sold to Guyana and Jamaica. But I have a slave registry. I have a letter from after the Mosses were put in jail. The white parliamentarians wrote. Well, they were all white. Parliamentarians wrote a letter to the governor requesting that they would be released, and there were other types of correspondence. In fact, including a letter written by Henry and Helen Moss while they were in prison, writing the I can't remember if it was the governor or the colonial secretary, were requesting, you know, mercy. So how did I do it? You know, as a I am first and foremost, I think, a playwright and a poet. And so fiction is something that I have found a challenge. But one good thing about being a playwright and trying to do this is that voices come to you easily. And so I had to use my imagination to recreate a world that I had never seen or lived in. And so I had to imagine what life on a plantation in Crooked Island would be like. And like any writer, you want to write what you know. And so I guess I'd lived long enough and worked long enough to have a sense of what, you know, and done enough reading and so on to have a sense of what the days would be like and what people would task. She was a house slave. So she worked in the house of Henry and Helen Moss, not in the fields. And so I, you know, could imagine the types of chores that they would do on a daily basis, etc. But the key was, how do I integrate these historical texts with my own imaginative recreation of these people? I had to create characters. I would lift names from the slave register and say, you know, I think this person would be, will work in the house as well, and this one, right? So, and the problem became, because I wanted to use the historical documents, but the language is very, it's arcane language. It's over 100 years old. So there are words today's readers never see anywhere. Even with a PhD in English, I never saw some of these words. I had no idea what they meant and had to go look them up and all the rest of it. So I'm like, how do I pare this down? And then there were documents I wish I had that I couldn't have. Like, for instance, there's a trial, but I don't have the closing argument of either the prosecution or the defense. So in any event, the key was to fill in the gaps, read between the lines. And another thing was, well, you know, Black people aren't allowed to testify in court in 1827, 1826. We aren't allowed to give testimony. So you're only really hearing from the slave owning class. And most of the witnesses are people who are their friends, come to vouch for how wonderful they treat their slaves, how decent they are, how merciful, how, you know, one person says, you know, well, this whip is a mild instrument. Okay. All these Black people, these Africans, there's real pepper in their churn. It's no big deal. So there were those types of things that were being said in the court. I wanted to use that, but I also wanted to accept the fact that, or remember the fact that they're lying. They're lying, right? They're lying. And so what stands as the actual official record, how much of it is really true? You know, how much of it is really true? And so I end up writing the story in a way that things happen. But some things happen in a way that's totally opposite to what the testimony in the court says. And so the reader will have quite a challenge as the book goes on, trying to figure out what's the historical record and what did Strawn make up, right?
Strawn, you are reading these records and you are reading these untruths, right?
Yeah.
What kind of emotions did that stir within you?
Oh, anger.
And how did you constrain those emotions so that you could be true to what you were writing? Or maybe you left them unbridled. I don't know.
Okay, so you want to let, you know, I think you want to let the testimony speak for itself. And what I stumbled upon, really, because I struggled for a long time and had people read it, and you know, I want to give credit to a former colleague of mine at university, Micheline Adams, Trinidadian writer and scholar, who you know, helped me read the script and gave me wonderful feedback. Emil Hunt, Keith Russell, Michael Stevenson, and Nicolette Bethel. What I ended up doing was, you know, I stumbled upon letting the testimony come in drips while the actual event was happening. So the reader can juxtapose. Here in this page, they are whipping this girl mercilessly. And then the next page, you have this planter who's a neighbor of the Mosses talking about how wonderful and kind and merciful they are, and how they care so much for their slaves and give them medicine when they're sick, blah, blah, blah. I didn't need to do anything other than that. I just juxtapose the two, right? And leave it to the reader for the hypocrisy, the falsehood, to just rise up off the page, and for them to feel the same anger and sickness in the stomach that I felt, right? So I don't have to, you know, it's not something that you need to, you know, need to lay on thick, because it's right, it's all right there. Once I came upon the accident of how to integrate the testimony into the story at the right times to provide a contrast between what the white people say and what actually is happening. Because the truth is, we'll never know all that really happened, because why should we believe them? They're all there trying to protect and get Helen Moss off. And by the way, I should say, credit must be given. The fact is, you know, not all white people in 1826, 1827 were merciless and cruel. You know, the Attorney General wanted to charge Henry and Helen Moss with murder. That's what they were brought to court to answer, a charge of murder. And the grand jury rejected that. And then a lesser charge of cruelty was brought. But up until the Attorney General's closing remarks, he said, this is a murder. You people won't charge them with this, but they killed this girl. And then when the pressure was brought to bear, because the governor was out of the colony at the time, Governor Grant, when the members of parliament are writing and the governor is on the side of the Mosses, because they all socialized together. They would have parties and beach picnics, go to Rose Island and be at the governor's mansion having dinner and celebrate King George's birthday, et cetera. And so it was a small group of socialites and so the governor was very familiar with Henry Moss and his wife, and he was very partial to them. So, but when the pressure was being brought to release them, to not charge them with this money, to shorten their sentence, it was Chief Justice William Vesey Munnings who was like, well, hell no, 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 these people deserve what they've gotten. And we're not going to do that. And then it went to the colonial. Now, Vesey Munnings was both Chief Justice and President of the Legislative Council. And then it went to the colonial secretary. So the ultimate decision was, we can't settle this here. The governor and the chief justice don't agree. We'll take it to the colonial secretary, who ended up being Huskinson. And he was like, why should I show mercy to people who showed no mercy to anyone? And so they spend their, I think it's 6 months, 5-6 months in jail. Nowhere near enough for the life of a person, but that was the moment we were in. And so what's interesting for me too is, how do I get into the minds of a slaveholding class that puts one of their own in jail for cruelty? You know, what would make them do that, right? Now, we know the moment we're in is one where the British government is applying pressure to the Bahamian Parliament to introduce improvements, to improve the lot of slaves, to protect slaves, to stop you from selling their, you know, separating families, and to stop you, to contain how much you can whip a person, you know, to allow them to get married. Various things, that the various reforms the British government is trying to impose. And the Bahamian Parliament is resisting. They don't want to do any of it. But the abolitionist movement is in full swing by 1826. And so that, I think, plays a part in how this all shakes out in the end, and how these people, the whites, were able to sentence them. But then shortly after regret it, And I'm like, you know, never mind, let them out, man, let them out.
I could just hear the complexities of the power dynamics and all of the human behavior. And as you did your story, as you were writing, you had to develop characters.
Yes.
You had to develop characters. How were you, you know, and you talked a little bit about it, you know, getting into the mindset of these people. And but how did you do that and bring a character to life and be true to the times in which they were living at and the emotional depth of that character?
Yeah, good
I'm
question.
very intrigued about.
So I, you know, I told some folks at a reading recently, how do you enter into the psychology of life on a plantation? Well, I've worked in the public service for over 20 years, and it's similar.
Wow. Not even only, not only paradise and plantation, public service and
The
plantation.
power dynamics. I mean, people behave towards power. I believe that that doesn't change. When you have people who are powerful, there are those who want to ingratiate themselves, who will be the minion of the powerful, who will mindlessly carry out any instruction given by the powerful, whether the instruction is good or evil, right? Then there are those who have the courage to say no to the powerful. That is not right. That is wrong. And then you have those who cannot say it to the powerful's face, but behind their back, they despise them, they undermine them, they do every little thing to say, I hate this regime and I want no part of it. Okay, so that's that. I just described the modern workplace in a highly politicized environment, right? In the public service, and it's the same on the plantation, except more extreme. All right, so instead of someone stealing paper or a stapler or you know whatever else your institution deals in. You steal something else, right? But you play sick. Slaves played sick, right? So there's there are car I didn't have to go that far. I just looked into my own ability to observe human behavior. And having been a leader in an organization, I have been able to observe human behavior under all of those circumstances, all of those different permutations. And what you have is some interesting people emerge on that plantation, again, lifting it from the testimony. When they contain Kate, she is confined with two other slaves. One is a boy who ran away named Johnny. And another is a woman named Harriet, who tried to kill her baby. Okay? Facts. That's the testimony. So now my imagination can run wild. I gotta create Johnny. What made this boy run away? What must it feel like to be able to run away? Right? What's his mindset? What's his spirit like? How have they not broken him? But then how is he now handling being caught, being punished? And then this woman, Harriet, who tries to kill her baby. And this is something that we may have never thought would have happened on plantations in the Bahamas. But it was common in slavery. And in fact, Toni Morrison's novel Beloved is all about that. Right? And so then you have to inhabit and give these people personalities and character. And then I wanted a window into the life of the whites. And someone who's close to them, observing them, overhearing their conversations. What does it look like from his point of view? So I found a slave on the list. His name is Bacchus. I choose him. He is the head house servant. He serves the master. He helps him, puts out his clothes, shines his shoes, brings him his wine, prepares, brings his food. And he has a perspective on the white people and the things they say. Because from time to time, they'll talk about what happened in Nassau or what happened in Parliament, what's in the Royal Gazette, the newspaper. And he happens to be best friends with Kate's father. Kate's father's name is Limerick. And so I end up creating a world around these people. And then there's we know that a cook named Lucy rubbed pepper in Kate's eyes. Well, Jesus. You, the slave, now take it upon yourself to mete out punishment on this girl. Do the work of the master, right? Well, you must be quite a character. You must be a piece of work, as our people say. A case and a half. And so I had fun creating Lucy, right? I had fun creating this cook who, you know, and clearly she just can't stand the guts of this girl to be disobedient to her master and her mistress, who clearly she must love to death. And then, of course, you have, on any plantation, you have slave drivers. You have the overseers who are white, but then you have slave drivers. These are black men whose job it is to manage work gangs and make sure they get the work done and keep them in order. So now here are slaves doing the bidding of the master, whipping and punishing their fellow slaves when they get out of line. And that's a curious job to have. That's a curious role to play. And we are told in the testimony that after Kate was released, she was sent out to work in the field. So she was demoted, banished from the house, and sent to work in the fields. And out in the fields, she was whipped by a slave driver and dies, collapses eventually and dies. All right? So, well, who is this slave driver? What is it like to stand in the middle? You're not the master. You are a slave, but you're a little above the slaves because you carry a whip. So the story gave me these opportunities to create these characters, and I give the slave driver the name of London. Again, I take it from the list. I decide, you know what, London, you are my slave driver. I don't know if London was a slave driver or not. But again, I have to use my imagination. I have to take creative license, right? And create this world. And those parts of it were fun. Writing the characters, their perspectives, how they feel about Kate. And then creating Kate as well. Giving her a life. Her emotions. Her aspirations. Give her dreams. And give her heartbreak, because we find out that her little sister dies shortly before this whole incident takes place, got sick. And so I think, well, how does that affect her mindset, her view, her attitude? So, yeah, that's pretty much how I did.
Yeah, you engaged all of your past, current, and future emotions on that.
Yeah, well, you know, again, you know, I like to... I have been thinking about how do I talk about this with modern Bahamians. And here's what I've come up with. You could look at this as a story about rich people in a big house who hire a poor girl to work in that house. They take advantage of her. They want to cover it up. They want her to be quiet about it and not say anything, but she refuses. They are well-connected, they are influential, but because she refuses to be silent and let herself be violated, it becomes a national sensation and they wind up in jail because she refuses to just be violated and be silenced. What I haven't said is, why were they punishing Kate? According to the record, they punish her because she refuses to mend her clothes. And because she stole some sugar and sixpence. Okay? So I don't know how far we are from the break, but I want to get into...
Yeah.
I want to get into that. Because I have a view on what really happened there.
Okay. So as a former host, you just know, you just can sense when the breaks are coming.
Yeah.
But yes, this is time for us to take a break. You're listening to University Drive. On the other side of the break, we'll continue to have this very intriguing conversation with Dr. Ian Strawn. Stay tuned.
Are you ready to take your knowledge or career to new heights? Don't wait to invest in your future. Do it now. How? Earn a professional development certificate from University of the Bahamas. Whether you're looking to enhance your leadership abilities, sharpen your technical skills, or explore a new field entirely, our Continuing Education and Lifelong Learning Center has the ideal course for you. We offer single-phase electrical, ethics and procurement, accounting for entrepreneurship, stop managing, start leading, dynamic presentations, digital marketing, superior customer service, and justice of the peace. We even have courses on smartphone photography, TikTok videos, defensive driving, and interacting with difficult people. Or open the door to new languages with English as a second language, conversational Chinese, and Spanish in the workplace. Our instructors are experts in their fields and they're here to support you every step of the way. Call us at 302-4449. Enroll today.
Chapter One Bookstore is proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael H. Eldon Complex on University Drive. Shop with us on Monday through Saturday. You can contact us at 397-2650 or email at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. Chapter One, the premier choice.
Welcome back to University Drive. Our guest is Dr. Ian Strawn. We're talking about his novel on Kate Moss and what happened to her all the way back in 1826 and what it sparked. And we were just about to get into what Kate, the slave girl, was accused of that got her into hot water, that led eventually to her death.
Right. So this doesn't add up to me. You steal some sugar. You steal sixpence. You won't mend your clothes. And for this, they put you in stocks. I don't know if people know what stocks are. Your hand and your head are put into this wooden contraption. And you can't sit. You can't lay down. And they put her in that for 17 days. And they whip her repeatedly. Okay? They rub pepper in her eyes. Or because you won't mend your clothes. And this is a girl. Okay? Girl. You know, I make her 14, but the Kate that I see in 1822 on the list is 8 years old. She means by 1826, she's only 12. But I make her 14. What happened here that would cause such a violent reaction to a domestic slave? She wasn't trying to start an insurrection. She's refused to mend her clothes. And so what I conclude is that she was raped. She was raped by this man. And this explains for me the over-the-top reaction of his wife, the over-the-top of the top reaction of Henry himself, of the cook, and all the others who beat this woman. She's beaten by about 6 or 7 different people, including her father. What if she is raped? Now this makes sense to me. She won't rent. She won't mend her clothes. And they tell her at one point, if you will just mend your clothes, we'll let you loose. And she refuses. And she says, I don't care what you do to me. That's fascinating to me. And so we know that in slavery, you are chattel. There's an advertisement in the Royal Gazette that I put in the book. And in the Gazette, they are advertising the sale of a family. It's a woman and 3 children. They never mention the father. The father isn't part of the family, apparently. Okay? So, but think about that, because you're not allowed to marry. You're not really allowed to have family. They can do with you what you want. You know, and so this man can rape these women if he wants. But what if you rape this girl in this house, you tear her clothes, but she refuses to fix the clothes and comes back to work. And that is basically what I decided to do with this story. She refuses to go along with the, I guess you could call it the lie that nothing happened. And she forces the mistress and the master to deal with the consequences of what they did. And it brings the whole plantation, to a standstill that this girl refuses. And in the novel, the mistress, who tore your clothes? And she asks her over and over again. And she never changes her story. Boss man, tear my clothes, right? So, and that is what is at the heart of this is first the crime of rape happening in the context of the greater crime of the captivity and exploitation of a people.
And her refusal to mend her clothes was her stand. It was her
Yes.
defiance. It was
Yes.
her way of mounting an insurrection
That's correct. And she didn't
against
need the
this.
strongest person physically on the plantation. She
Yeah.
didn't need to. Right? Simply by insisting on her own dignity and insisting on her truth and being seen as someone who was violated, she turned the thing upside down. Right? And she was not afraid to die, which is the essence of how, I hate to say it, it's how great things get done. When Bahamians in 1958 stopped working, as my late colleague Felix Bethel said, when they refused to work, they decided they would not eat. And when they decided they would not eat, they decided they were prepared to die. That's what a general strike was. We will not work. Right? That's what Burma Road was. You will not get away with not paying us what we deserve. Right? That is what Martin Luther King stood for. He said, if you can't find something to die for, you ain't really living. So this woman, Kate, is a hero. She is a national hero. And speeches were referencing her in the House of Parliament years after her death. And she helped bring the momentum of reform and change. She didn't live to see it, but those who were around and who cared about her did live to see it. And so the story is not just one of tragedy or suffering and loss, it is also about great heroism and the power of a single decision not to be made invisible, not to be silenced, not to let those who have hurt you get away with it.
I want to add to that, bravery and courage in one so young, coming up against the cruelty, the animalistic natures, and the disgustingness
Yeah.
of people who were two and three times her age,
Black and white.
black and white.
Yeah.
That must be something to see in a fictional representation, all made by Dr. Ian Strachan. What do you want readers of this novel to feel and to do at the end of it?
Well, I mean, I remember being a boy and watching Roots, right? And it was transformational. Transformational for me. It left an indelible impression on my young mind. Watching a white man whip a slave and saying, "Your name is Toby." And he says, "No, my name is Kunta Kinte." Right? That dramatization of what happened to millions of us changed my life, changed my perspective. gave me a consciousness. Gave me a consciousness of who I am, of how I got here, and of the price my ancestors paid. But not only that, of my inheritance and of my obligation. And I am not a person who, I am not a, how can I put this? I believe in, you know, in the human family. I do. I believe God loves us all, and white, black, yellow, red, doesn't, I get that. But fundamentally, in 2023, I am a black man, an African, in a world where blacks and Africans are probably the least valued people on the planet. I think the Native Americans would argue that they have us beat. I can accept that. Today, black people are not valued as they should. Today, they are exploited. Today, they are violently and arbitrarily killed and confined and jailed and sentenced. Today, they are denied their rights. Today, right? Not 1826, 2023. And so my hope is that this book would awaken a consciousness in those who need it. That it would fill a gap, as I started out early talking about the void. And I think it's personal for me, you know, holding up. I grew up in a broken home. I didn't know my father. I feel like I met him for the first time when I was 8 years old. I had no memories of him before that. There are all of these things about my own childhood past and my family history that are just blanks. And it made me someone who was a collector, someone who hoards information and wants to know how things. When my first son was born, I bought the newspaper and put it in plastic. I still have the newspaper from, you know, 2005. This is what happened in the world the day you were born. I don't want my children to not know where they come from, to not have answers, to not know one side of their family because daddy and mommy broke up. So it is important to me on a personal level to know the past, to have answers to the questions. And I certainly hope that this will help answer some questions for people about who we are, what we went through, how we struggled. And don't think for a minute that we were just passive victims, not fighting back. Bob Marley has a song, Buffalo Soldier, right? Stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting on arrival, fighting for survival. And that's what we were. We have always been fighting. And we're still fighting. And we cannot stop fighting. And the most important thing is, even if you know you cannot win, still fight. Still fight. Because you, no one can take your dignity from you. And though you lose, you may allow others who come behind you to win. Right? And so this girl knew she couldn't win, but she still fought. And we as Bahamians need to rediscover that, in my opinion. Rediscover that. We're afraid. We're passive. We're lazy. We're selfish and self-involved. And we are not stepping up to fight for our country and for our children. What we are prepared to do is let them get on the plane and go and don't come back. While others will come and enjoy our country. And Pinland said, if you're not prepared to fight for your country, you don't deserve to have it. That's still true today. And that's what I hope you'll get from me.
Profound, profound. Thank you, listeners, for joining us for this episode of University Drive. It's been our pleasure bringing it to you. Join us again next time for another exciting episode. I'm Tamika Lundy. Take care. Bye for now.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.